This is the March 25 edition of Commodity Week.
Todd Gleason services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Well, welcome to Commodity Week. I am Todd Gleason. Our panelists for the day include Arlen Suderman. He's at StoneX out of Kansas City, Missouri. Chuck Shelby is here from Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana. And we're joined by John Bondurant at Bondurant Futures in Memphis, Tennessee. Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online. Listen to us on demand anytime you'd like at willag.org. If you scroll all the way to the bottom of the page, you'll find links to some podcast applications you might use with your phone and hook us right up there to the Bluetooth radio in your plant or tractor. Places like Stitcher and SoundCloud, NPR One, Google Podcast, Apple Podcast, and even Spotify. Let's begin by asking John Bondurant to bring us up to speed on what's been happening in his world there in Memphis and how he sees things in general. John, thank you for being with us again.
Well, it's nice to be here. Been a while. Oh, nothing much changed here. Still being a speculator and being a farmer and hedging. I was thinking, people have asked me this before, but I've been an aggressive hedger for 25, 30 years, anytime the market allows. And about 6 months ago, I decided I wasn't going to hedge anything because I was scared to death of the central banks, and I still am, inflation. And so here I am. The market's real high, and I got nothing hedged. Maybe I should, but I don't.
Are you thinking real hard about it?
No, not particularly. I really am concerned about central banks printing money.
Now, they've been printing money for 2 years now, nearly. Again.
Yeah, but it just keeps compounding.
Is there a difference between this time around, you think, than in the 08 time frame?
In what respect?
Well, they printed a lot of money then as well, not nearly as much, and maybe that's the big difference.
That's the big difference, and plus, every central bank in the world is doing it now. That's what's, and doing it more than we've ever seen. The EU bank, the Japanese bank, Chinese, everybody's doing it, and everybody's broke. So I keep thinking that the purchasing power of the dollar has got to go down, whether you call that inflation or whatever you want to call it.
Arlen Suderman, I bet you've considered this.
I certainly have, and I would agree that this is happening with central banks around the world. When we look at how the Fed has increased its balance sheet year on year, about 78%, unprecedented the amount of money. In fact, about $4 trillion added to M1 money supply over the past year. Again, unprecedented that we've ever seen that kind of money coming into the economy. And then when they survey people on where the money is going, it first started off with paying credit card debts last spring when the first checks went out because people were worried about the future of the economy, so they wanted to reduce some of their debt. Then they started feeling a little better about the economy, and they started spending that money on refinancing their home, upgrading their homes to new homes, upgrading their cars, taking advantage of zero interest rate car loans. And then when we saw the $600 checks go out in January, we saw a surge of consumer spending and retail investment in the markets. And I think that's when we saw the biggest amount of people coming into the markets investing it. And with this $1,400 check going out now, people were surveyed about how are you going to spend the $1,400. It's interesting to note just about every age demographic said that they were going to put some of it into the markets. The 25 to 34-year-olds said they were going to put half of their checks into the markets. And you add it all together, all demographics, over $100 billion coming into the markets. That changes how the markets balance supply and demand all the way to the farm gate. It feeds inflation. And so I would agree that that's a significant concern going forward.
Well, why does it feed inflation? I think what I really want you to tell me about is the difference between that kind of money in the general marketplace and money in commodity futures, which seek a price kind of no matter how much money is there for an underlying grain, oil, seed, precious metal or something along those lines.
Say inflation of inputs. You know, tractors cost a fortune. A cotton picker's $800,000. I noticed that fertilizer for corn liquid N's up 35% from a year ago.
Well, we've certainly seen in Indiana some significant land sales in the last 6 weeks, Todd, that are unprecedented sales, and that market changed dramatically just from December. So producers and investors are certainly willing to put their money into land, and it's a pretty dramatic increase. To John's point there, too, I know certain manufacturers are increasing their machinery prices here beginning April 1st, minimally 4%, and probably later on in the next round, it'll be 5 to 6% higher for new machinery.
Chuck Shelby, of course, is with Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana. Chuck, did it change in recent weeks the way you have approached new crop?
You know, you got to take a lot of things into consideration here. And I'm a little bit in John's camp of hesitant to make a lot of sales here. We've got a great demand-based market. It's going to be real interesting next week how many acres we're going to put forward, and especially in the soybean market. Guys, it seems like it's an almost impossible task to certainly try to increase the carry out with what's going on. So a lot of things going on, a pretty dynamic market we have here.
Earlier this week, Arlen, IHS Market put out a number that was better than 94 million acres for corn. Is that a good number in your opinion?
It's a little bit high in my opinion. If you look at it state by state and where those acres may come from, we may lose some continuous corn acres in some places. It depends. Some places corn pencils out better than soybeans. Other places soybeans better. But most farmers want to keep their rotations. I was talking to a fellow broadcaster who was doing a meeting, emceeing a meeting of about 250 or so good producers from across the core of the Midwest. And he said, and this was just a few weeks ago, said, how many of you plan on changing your acreage mix this year? And only a handful of hands went up. They like to stick to the rotation. So when you look at where the acres are going to come from, is we have about 8 million acres of prevent plant from last year for corn and soybeans that was highly concentrated in the Dakotas. That's going to favor soybeans. You've got about 2.5 million acres of CRP ground contracts that were not renewed, again, heavily biased toward the plains. And then you have the opportunity for double cropping soybeans across the southern Midwest and into the plains. It really means that our biggest adjustment in acreage is going to come from areas that are a little less favorable toward corn. That's why I see the big jump in soybean acres and less so in corn right now.
John, farmers always like me to ask, because I usually have you on at about this time of year, what you've decided to do with the farmland in your part of the world there in Memphis. And as you said, you tend to be pretty bold, and I know that there have been years where you've made just split decisions and went one way or the other at the last moment. Have things changed for you in the last 3 to 4 months?
I think it's more up my air than it's ever been. And we're right now in the start of the planting season. Like, for instance, Louisiana, and I'll take the Arkansas border south. It's probably 75-85% planted in corn as we speak. We had a big rain today. We have a clear forecast. We're going to see in our area, we're going to see a fair drop in, I think, cotton acres. I think cotton acres will be down 1 million acres, and I'm way on the left field. Most people think it's unchanged. I do not. Beans are heavily favored. So my farms are going to be about 90% beans and 10% corn and no cotton.
Chuck, what's your assessment?
Well, I think you've got some other commodities that are a decent price. Wheat's a pretty good price, hasn't been this high for quite some time. Grain sorghums are a really good price for producers in certain areas of the country. I just think that pushing 93 million or 92 million corn and 90 million beans is top-end numbers when you consider other commodities. So, again, it's going to be a huge total amount of production crops, but I guess going forward, it's all about what the yield's going to be, and I think producers have pretty much made up their minds unless the soybean market really shoots higher next week if we don't have enough acres.
Marlon, did you mention what figures you were working with directly?
Yeah, I have corn acres at 92.85 million and soybeans at 90.5 million. And even at that 90.5 million soybean acres, we just kind of maintain tight supplies over the coming year with a trend yield. So it's troubling to me that I see some of these private estimates coming out under 90 million, because that's going to necessitate more rationing if we don't get a bumper yield.
What are you looking forward to in the grain stocks, Harlan?
For the grain stocks report coming out, I'm looking for corn stocks at 7.587 billion, soybeans at 1.483 billion. And that's a significant drop from where we were a year ago, reflecting the aggressive crush pace and export pace that we've had. And I foresee some shortages, regional shortages of soybeans here as we go through the summer. All wheat at 1.227 billion, which again is down a couple hundred million from a year ago.
What does the livestock sector look like, Chuck, from your perspective, and how does that play into the grain stocks figures?
Well, the hog producer is looking at some really great prices now after really struggling. So production there is on the increase. Those are fantastic prices out there in the summertime. A lot of hogs out there to feed. The cattle producers got a decent price, but as you look forward, I hope the cookout demand will pick up and restaurants will pick up. So I think livestock prices are in a very good position, and I think that's a demand that's going to be there. And it's going to be strong as we move into, you know, the growing season and all the way into 22.
John, because the poultry industry is so vertically integrated, it did not suffer in the beginning of the COVID problems a year ago and for the first several months, the same kind of issues in the supply chain that pork and beef did. That's mostly raised in the South. And then, of course, you have the export market directly very close to where you are, just not very there at Memphis. And I'm wondering, have your basis levels remained really strong all the way through?
Yes. No, the basis levels right now are really strong. And everybody's 60 over November for beans, if you can get them in SEPOC. That's a big price. Big price. So basis levels are quite high, and farmers are quite excited and want to get the crops in early, and they're trying. And they'll, if the weather stays good for a week or 10 days, it's going to be over. I mean, they're going to plant everything they can get their hands on.
Do you have very much storage capacity on farmer in elevators?
No.
No. So most everything, it's all gone.
Yeah.
So basis levels remain strong in large part, but they're working really hard to get it in so they can get it out and get
the premium.
A quick ship premium, right?
Yes.
How do you see this playing out, John, into the fall, given what you're hearing about grain stocks and at least until we get the USDA reports next week, the prospective plantings numbers? Well, if you had to take a guess today, prices higher or lower? You're guessing higher, but on inflation, I assume.
Yes. And, you know, we've got the obvious problem. We hadn't got near enough bean stocks, and exports of beans look like they're probably going to be 50 to 100 million higher than the government estimate. Corn exports, maybe 200-300 higher. I'm worried about the stocks and all positions report because they throw so many curves at us there. I'd like to touch on one thing and see what y'all think about this. China has been buying an incredible amount of stuff. And yet, according to the latest USDA world crop estimates, China has 150 million bushels of 150 million tons of wheat of 301 million. That's 5.5 billion. In corn, they have 196 million tons or 7.7 billion bushels of, 287 billion is a total stock number at the end of the year, of which China is 196. If China has all these reserves, why in the world are they buying? My point is, a few years ago, the USDA just arbitrarily raised all the Chinese stocks immensely, and the market said, okay. And here we are four or five years later, and China has got all these enormous stocks, and they're buying like crazy. The obvious answer is maybe they're not there. I was wondering what y'all think about this.
Well, I think when you look at the price of corn in China related to the U.S. price, when it's $10, $11 a bushel, that's telling you something. And if you were a Chinese buyer, you look at the price of corn here, even if you included shipping, that's still a bargain price. I think another factor, too, we had a pretty good quality crop last year, so they're interested in stockpiling. And I think there's a little bit of concern when you look at the crop in South America, especially the second crop, Brazilian corn. So the Chinese are pretty shrewd at evaluating the world situation, and I think they've got, you know, a couple different reasons why they may be stockpiling, let alone maybe they don't even have that much.
Well, that's the obvious answer, is that maybe they never had it. And I'm wondering if that's, in fact, what's going on.
That would really fit with what our boots on the ground in China say, with our staff and our customers in China, that USDA is overstating corn stocks in China. Their reserves are just very low right now. Their wheat stocks are using up rather rapidly. Since September, they've released nearly 40 million metric tons of wheat, most of that feed. So they're feeding a lot of wheat right now. We figured this year's corn deficit in China is about 30 million metric tons, so they've already replaced that. But they're trying to, you know, most of this or all of it virtually is being bought by their state grain agency, which would put it right back into the reserve. Their problem is their reserve storage is up in northern areas near the production. Where they need it is really in southern areas. So about the only real storage there is at the ports. Well, that's where the soybeans are stored for crush. So there could be a real problem here in what they do with that corn, trying to bring in all the corn plus soybeans, plus trying to get enough ships to haul it. But certainly there is a price advantage to do it, because their government can make a lot of money here, $2 a bushel or so for importing it, putting in reserve, and then releasing it in auction and make a good profit on it. So if they truly needed the corn, I mean, were desperate for it, they would approve the phytosanitary agreements with Brazil. And they simply have been dragging their feet on it. They don't need it until the feed wheat is all out of their reserve, and at that time they will. But we're also hearing chatter on the ground that their climatologists, who they believe are the best in the world, maybe they are, maybe they aren't, I don't know, are raising a warning sign with them that we're going to have a short Safrina corn crop in Brazil, and we're going to have an adverse summer in the U.S. Midwest, creating a shortage, a global shortage of corn. So get the corn now.
Yeah, so that was kind of a follow-up question that I had for you, which Arlen, or anybody else, but we'll start with Arlen since he mentioned it, which is, what's the possibility that they simply looked at the weather that has already taken place in Brazil and said that crop is so far behind, they're likely to go dry fast, we're not sure the Safrina crop will be there, we're going to book it from the United States, but we may not necessarily take it.
Yeah, I think that's a real possibility, although this last purchases were immediate shipment in April versus previously they were buying it for shipment out into the future. So there seems to be a little bit more urgency now. We'll see if they can get the boats lined up. The other factor that may be there, I don't know, it's a little bit more why they'd be buying it from the United States now and trying to get it shipped is I'm hearing more analysts and military side saying that they believe that China is closer to a move on Taiwan, and that would cut off could cut off opportunities to purchase from the United States. They could always go to Brazil at a later date if they wanted to. But I think probably the more pressing thing is what they're seeing for production risks in Brazil and the United States this year.
John Bondurant, I was on a Zoom call with U.S. Secretary of Agriculture Tom Vilsack yesterday, and he was asked about ASF in China and if he had any new information. He had just met with the Chinese and asked them about it. He kind of laughed. He did laugh, actually, and said that the Chinese tell him that they have it under control. He, however, is not convinced that's the case. How much demand do you think they really have, given the problems they're continuing to have in their hog herds?
Well, that's a hell of a question. You know, the entire, well, not the entire, but, what, 80, 90% of this bull move in commodity and grains is based on China. And they just came out of the blue buying like crazy all of a sudden. Now, is that something that's going to go on long term, or is it just a one-shot deal? I still subscribe the theory they never had it. That's been the idea that they've got corn in there that's been 5 years in storage. What's the value of five-year-old corn? I know it doesn't store very well for me.
It would have to be really far north and really dry, I would think, Chuck Shelby, in order to pull that off.
we have a hard time after 1 year. So I don't know the answer to the swine flu. I just don't know.
I think it's interesting that we're seeing crush right now at about 1.5, 1.6 million metric tons per week, basically equal to where we were a year ago when we estimated from our people on the ground that hog feeding was down maybe 60% from pre-ASF levels. And we're seeing soy meal supplies actually fairly steady, if not grow a little bit, with that lower crush level. We ought to be much higher crush if we were still had the hogs there. China just came out to report their Ministry of Agriculture that the sow population grew 1.1% in January and 1% in February, and it's at 95% of pre-ASF levels. And our people on the ground are saying the sow herd dropped 5% in both January and February, continues to drop. And when you look at piglet prices, this week, they're 4 to 5 times what they were pre-ASF, suggesting that there's a tight supply of those piglets. So they've got a problem with African swine fever. They don't have it under control. We're not expecting another collapse of the industry like what we saw in 18 and 19, but it is a problem they have not got under control yet.
Let's come back to domestic usage, and I do want to ask Chuck again of you about ethanol this time around and its usage. I think it's gotten to about 85% of pre-COVID demand. Is there any reason really to think that it'll get much better than that?
Well, we've sold a fair amount of ethanol to China, which is a positive that was kind of expected before the tariff war. So their purchases are important, and I think hopefully as we move into summer, there's a huge pent-up demand for Americans who want to go out, do all the things that we did a year or so ago before pre-COVID. So I think ethanol demand will pick up pretty significantly, and I think the Chinese purchases over time will be another positive that have kind of made up for some of the loss of driving in the United States and ethanol demand here.
Has StoneX done an assessment of what they think miles driven might be and whether people will actually be back on the road, not for vacation, in particular, but for daily commutes?
Yeah, as we talk to our customers in the industry, there is a sense that we could go back to pre-COVID levels of demand because of this desire to get out, but still some reluctance to fly. And so that'll help, particularly in the summertime, as was mentioned, bring the driving back. We're also seeing some pretty good export demand hold up. As I was looking at the data yesterday, down for Brazil, what we normally ship to Brazil, but many of our other customers, we're still seeing some pretty good export movement yet to some of our other customers. I was really surprised. And then you add the Chinese business on top of that. So it's a little better export business than what I anticipated. But hopefully we will see those people get back to driving and get those miles driven back to where they were prior to COVID.
So as I've been listening to this, it strikes me that demand for agricultural commodities across the planet is being driven, and this is true, is still being driven by China, though each of you have reservations about how much of that will continue or whether they can, whether there, that demand is truly there for the short term. I don't know, maybe different for the long term, but for the short term. And so I'm wondering whether it's inflation or demand that drives prices, and I touched on this earlier in our conversation, into the fall timeframe. And does that really make any difference, I suppose, for how farmers and others think about pricing crops? I think maybe I'll start with you, John, and then do Chuck and Arland.
Well, I see where you're going. supply and demand doesn't really reflect inflation, but inflation, I guess, the purchasing power of the dollar is what counts, and inputs are going up. So to that extent, it does put a price, higher price level. But I sort of agree with you. Supply and demand in beans and corn is an everyday thing, and it's not an inflation thing. But I went through the 70s and 80s with very high inflation, and never seen anything like what's happening now. No one ever had a printing press like this. I'm twixt and tween.
What's a unique combination of factors that we probably never seen together? We have demand, inflation, and you have low interest rates for a while here. So those combinations are certainly so unique and tend to make us, I think, sit back and pause for a while because it's not a typical market where you run up here and you know, one of the components goes away and the market falls apart. But in my mind, one of the bigger factors is what the weather is going to be. And obviously the Chinese are very tuned into that. So I don't see this market going away or falling apart until we're very sure how many acres we're going to have and what kind of yield we're going to have.
Yeah, I was going to say, in a good example of how this plays out is with the money that's in the hands of the consumer right now. During the pandemic, one of the surprising things that unfolded was an 11% increase in meat purchases by consumers. We thought with the restaurants closed that we would see a decline in meat consumption because portions tend to be smaller at home, you keep your leftovers, etc. But an 11% increase in meat and poultry purchases by consumers. And we saw that the consumer spent a lot of time educating him or herself about how to prepare that meat, what cuts were there, etc. And therefore bought more meat. And that's a trend that we think will increase the demand for meat, not only for years to come, but maybe generations to come. But when that demand for meat is higher, that's pushing the price of livestock higher, raising the break-even price so that instead of rationing, which we would normally be doing at $5.50 corn, we're still buying corn to feed these animals. And so we continue to buy it, and that's strengthened. So it all feeds in and has its roots in the fact that money supply is simply bigger. And end users, when they see inflation, they think, well, I've just got to pay more. They pay more for the inputs. That keeps the demand higher, and it just kind of the circle feeding on itself. When money supply is high, you tend to have inflation. It affects supply and demand. Supply and demand is a necessary component of it, but they work together.
John asked about clean diesel, renewable diesel, and we've been talking about this on our air for some time now. It is the kind of diesel that can be produced from soybean, from the soybean. However, it's a different process, and rather than like soy diesel, which can only be part of a gallon, this is a one-for-one swap, and that's because it's done at the refinery under a different process. I'm wondering, Arlen, how much of a marketplace there might be for this. USDA has already said they're going to add, and I don't know whether it's to the WASD or somewhere else, a line item for renewable diesel. I assume it will be for the month in the monthly WASD reports. Did not get to ask that question yesterday of Secretary Vilsack, though it was on my list. What do you think of it as a product and potential for it to create demand?
It's a tremendous product, and believe it or not, one of the high uses of this renewable that we're seeing is for air travel, for airplanes, jets, I should say. And so we have a lot of demand users who have said, you produce it, we will buy it. It just has a lot more uses than regular biodiesel. And we've got two new plants opening up in the United States this spring. We've got a number of other plants in the works at various stages. And as we look at supply and demand balance sheets, we basically have a deficit of soy oil built into our balance sheets for the next 5 to 8 years that continues to grow, that there's going to be more capacity than what there is soy oil to use. Because a lot of the plants in the United States are being designed specifically for processing soy oil.
Well, that means we're going to need 95 million acres of soybeans in the next 2 or 3 years then, if this continues. So I'm all for it.
Well, yeah, with the one problem, right, which is what do you do with all the bean meal?
Yeah, that's another one. I've got a report I'm looking at from Goldman Sachs that was written in October, and they're saying that by 2024, we will have 2.1 billion gallons worth of plants on stream, and 8 pounds per gallon, that is 16.6 billion pounds of some kind of feedstock. And if you look at that in relation to the soybean oil crush, it's 25 billion. So that's a staggering number. Mm-hmm. It's like saying we got 50% more demand, or more than 50% more demand. Of course, it's liable. This may not all happen, but gosh, it's a big deal.
Could be a big deal coming forward. You can find more on our website at willag.org. I had an interview with Scott Irwin, biofuel specialist, agricultural economist here on the Urbana-Champaign campus earlier in the week. I've not separated that out, but it should be up on the page soon enough, and so you can listen to that as well. Let's get a final word now from each of you. Arlen Suderman, we'll start with you today from StoneX.
Yeah, I think we're moving into a period of inflation. It doesn't have to affect every asset out there, but it's generally going to affect most assets. Central bank policy is key to that, but we also have supportive fundamentals, which are attracting that money to come into it. With the increased position limits that went into effect on March 15th, we anticipate greater volatility in the markets, higher highs and lower lows. So it's going to be important that farmers do have a plan, that they be prepared to act when the time is right, depending on their individual operation, to take some of the emotions out of it. But we do see a lot of opportunities in agriculture over the next few years.
Chuck Shelby from Risk Management Commodities out of Lafayette, Indiana.
Well, John brought up a point about the 70s and those of us who lived through that. The old saying was back in that day, you better buy today because it's going to be higher tomorrow. So that seems to be the kind of environment we're in, and opportunities are going to be good. It's just how you take advantage of them.
And John Bondurant of Bondurant Futures out of Memphis, Tennessee.
Wish you hadn't asked me. I think we're in for tremendously volatile markets. And it's going to be really, I think you got to pay attention to your basis levels. When they're good, hit the basis levels and price it later when you think it's right. But I'm basically a bull, if you can tell.
Commodity Week is a production of Illinois Public Media. Find us online. Listen to us on demand. You can hear the whole of the program there anytime you'd like at WILLAG.org. Our thanks go to our panelists today, including Chuck Shelby. He's out of Risk Management Commodities in Lafayette, Indiana. John Bondurant joined us from Memphis, Tennessee at Bondurant Futures. And Arlen Suderman was here as well from Stonax in Kansas City, Missouri. I'm Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason.